Timothy on the spot.
There we go. So, and when we talked about the God's judgment and the there in Revelation 14, that they are trampled in the winepress outside the city there in the last verse of chapter 14, of course, we think of the battle hymn of the Republic, where the grapes of wrath are stored, and this time it's the Jerusalem of God, and these all are going to die outside of the city, just as Jesus died on the outside of the city. And we looked at that as well in Hebrews, the 13th chapter. And the city that's been measured out and protected and marked for not for destruction is the New Jerusalem, which is also we talked about in Revelation 11. Now, it's interesting here that it says that the blood flowed out of the press. But the grapes were the things that were put in. And the grapes of wrath are really the cry of the saints under the altar for vengeance. And now that's being poured out. It's because of their blood. And again, we mentioned last week that it's unfortunate that if you have a New American Standard Bible, that it says that it flowed for a distance of 1,600 stadia. If you have the NASB, they had up to 200 miles. And, you know, that's wonderful that they told us how far 1,600 stadia is, but you don't want to just take numbers and things that are given in Revelation and give them a literal meaning, because it's not literal. And the distance I looked up today, just out of curiosity, the distance that you would walk from Dan to Beersheba. And Dan to Beersheba is a common reference in the Old Testament. This is such and such is going to go on from Dan to Beersheba. If you're a crow and you're flying from Dan to Beersheba, it's about 150 miles. If you're walking, it's going to be close to 200 miles. And so when you take the 1,600 stadia, 16 is 4 squared. And the 100 is 10 squared. And so you have this, the land and its fullness in the sense of being squared. And then you have the completeness and its totality when it's squared. You multiply those by each other, the 16 and the 100, then you have the 1600. So that the sign is saying that the totality of the land here is going to be under blood. Though Palestine is literally smaller than that, the meaning, the point is no one was going to escape. None of those who were unfaithful to God, that rejected the Messiah, are going to escape that. Did you have a question, Mike?
What I didn't get, how we decided this was the city, because I was looking for the press outside the city. Well, so the others were inside the city?
Those that were saved were inside the city. They are the ones that are marked out for protection in Revelation 11. So everybody outside of that, in the figure of it, is everybody else that's not in the temple of God or in his care and under his protection.
So you're going back to Revelation 11, and I didn't think we could go back in different visions and different groups and say, well, this must be the same city that it was talking about.
And again, it's because it was outside the city where Jesus was. So it would be, what city are we talking about?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I was looking.
Yeah, it's got to be I believe that it is the New Jerusalem. Okay. That we're going to read about in chapter 21.
Because I didn't see that anywhere, and I was trying not to make a conclusion from that. And that's why you were.
Well, in some sense that those who are inside the city are going to be okay. Because it's only those outside the city that are going to be punished. And it's also where Jesus was crucified.
Okay, I took it, sorry, I'm stopping you. So, but they were trampled in the winepress outside the city.
Right.
So the winepress was outside the city, but what does that have to do with where the people came from and who was saved and who wasn't? It's just the winepress was outside the city.
I guess when we see in the next chapter, when it's the bowls, and actually chapter 16, when the bowls are poured out on all the people. Okay. This is a growing vision here that's going to really culminate. Well, 16 begins the culmination of the whole thing. If you look at chapter 15 and verse 1, that this is this is where the wrath of God is going to be complete. Then we see them coming out of the temple, and they've got these chalices filled with the wrath of God that's just been trampled, and it's going to be poured out on the people. And that's all in chapter 16, is where those seven chalices are. Now, the fact that it says that it was up to the bridles of the horse. Yes?
You were just talking about the 1600, so I kept waiting. I was thinking our answer to all questions is here, because like catastrophes, 40 days, 40 nights, flood, 40 years in the wilderness. Well, this is 40 times 40.
Yeah, there you go. There's another one. I hadn't even thought about that. I was taking 16 times 100. But it is 40 times 40 is 1600 as well. Thank you.
Yep.
When I talk about something coming up to the bridles of the horses and the sense of death and danger, what does anything come to your mind?
I just think of the horses of the Roman Empire.
Okay. Yes.
The chariots during the parting of the Red Sea.
Okay, so in the Red Sea. So let's go over to Exodus chapter 14. And in fact, this kind of introduces the whole Egypt motif and deliverance from Egypt motif that we're going to see as the seven chalices are poured out. They have corresponding plagues with them from this time period. So if you somebody read chapter 14 and then first verse 23 and then verse 28. Who's got that? Okay, Tim.
The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea.
That verse 28.
The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived.
Okay. So we have the Red Sea. And what is this that's coming up to the bridles of the horses? What color is blood?
Red.
And so you have this correspondence here of the blood and the Red Sea. And in fact, as we get into chapter 15, what's the song that's going to be sung and that we're going to sing in just a few minutes?
Moses.
The Song of Moses. And when was that sung? That was sung right after, actually in two places, in Exodus and in Deuteronomy. It's going to be sung again. And so and if you're still in Exodus, I'm not, but I've got to go back there now. Exodus chapter 15, and you see parts of this song, and somebody read verses 1 through 5. King Cross.
Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he casts into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps cover them, they went down into the depths like a stone.
Now verses 9 and 10.
The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, my hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind, the seas covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters.
Okay, so again, these are parts of the Song of Moses that was first sung, the Song of Moses and Miriam in this particular case. There's going to be, again, and I'm not going to take the time to read it, but you can turn over there if you'd like. Just to look at it, in Deuteronomy chapter, I think it's chapter 32. Yes, and here is the Song of Moses, and again given to the people to recite and to remember. And if you'll go over to verse 44, we find out who else helped him teach that song, and who was it?
Joshua.
Yeshua. The Greek name for Yeshua is what?
Jesus.
Jesus. And so you have Moses and the Lamb, in a sense there as well, figuratively portrayed for us. So this Exodus imagery of the Red Sea and the destruction of God's enemies as they are trying to attack his people is going to continue, especially in chapter 16, with the bowls or chalices, the judgments that are going to be going to go out with the seven bowls here. And of course, we're going to see it right at the beginning here of chapter 15 as well. So any questions on this last end of chapter 14? All right, so chapter 15, verses 1 through 4, we read, I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues, last because with them God's wrath is completed. And I saw what looked like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and standing beside the sea, those who had been victorious over the beast and his image, and over the number of his name. They held harps given them by God and sang the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Who will not fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. And so, as we open this particular part up, and I'm sorry I don't have a slide for that. I guess I can move us forward here. Just in anticipation. We looked at Eusebius or Eusebius, is how I pronounce it. And I'll get there on my thing here as well. No, not yet. So John sees another great and noteworthy sign in heaven. The last time we saw a great and noteworthy sign in heaven, it was the woman and the dragon. And those were the original players. And so now we're coming to the climax of that conflict. And another great sign is now seven angels with seven bowls or seven chalices containing seven plagues. And they are, according to verse 7, the seven bowls filled with the wrath of God. Listen, these parallel the seven trumpets that we saw earlier and are in line with the seven seals that we saw at the very beginning. And in fact, it says in these seven bowls, the wrath of God is complete. If you go back to chapter 10 of Revelation and verse 7, it says, but in the days when the seventh trumpet is, the seventh angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. So there was a finishing of the announcement with the seventh trumpet. Now with the seventh bowl, when it's done, we are going to see that the wrath of God is going to be complete. So everything's been working towards this point. Not complete in the sense of God's wrath and judgment of all people and all time in the end of the world, but in the sense of the purpose of this book and what's being revealed, which is the judgment against Israel, the judgment against Jerusalem, and the old covenant world order that God had put in place as a tutor. And it's just like, okay, I'm done with the tutor, he's fired, now we're on to real life with Jesus Christ. And that's going to be done once and for all. And at that point, somebody turn for me to Hebrews chapter 8. And all of a sudden, as I'm looking at my reference here, I'm not liking what I read. Because I didn't put a 3 at the end of my 1. So I need somebody to read Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13. Okay, Tammy?
In that he says a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. But that which is becoming obsolete and grows aged is near to vanishing away.
Okay, so the old covenant, the old agreement that God had made is growing obsolete and is going to be taken away. It's going to vanish away. So within this context of the book, the judgment that we're talking about is the judgment on Jerusalem, the removal of that whole system of worshiping God and approaching God, and again, within the context of the beginning and the end of this book, these are things that are going to take place shortly. Okay. So the next thing that we see that John saw after these angels, he says, I saw what looked like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and let's just stop right there. So he saw a sea of glass. If you go back to chapter 4 of Revelation and verse 6, as he sees the throne in heaven, John sees it in his vision, it says, also before the throne there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. And so there it was clear as crystal. It's also paralleling, if you go back to Exodus 24, Exodus 24 is when Moses and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders went up on the mountain and ate and drank with God. Listen, don't ask me how that happened or what that is there, because I'm still wondering about that. But what did they see in verse 10 there before God?
Pavement made of lapis lazuli.
Okay.
And bright blue as the sky.
All right, sapphire. And mine says a pavement made of sapphire. So yours has lapis lazuli. I've heard of that, Jim. And mine says clear as the sky. Yours says as blue as the sky, right? Okay. So again, I see of glass. This was a pavement of glass, an expanse of glass. And in this case, it was blue. I would assume that the glass there in chapter 4 and verse 6 is clear as crystal. It may have been blue as well. Now somebody turn to 1 Kings chapter 7 as we read about the temple that Solomon is building and talking about the furnishings of that temple. And somebody read for me verses 23 through 26. 1 Kings chapter 7, 23 through 26.
Hey, Dan.
Yes.
Really quick, can you tell me what Exodus that was? What verse?
The passage in Exodus was, yes, I can tell you that, 24:10.
Thank you.
This is 1 Kings 7, 23 through 26. Okay, Emily?
And he made a sea of cast metal. It was round, 10 cubits from brim to brim, and 5 cubits high, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference.
Go through verse 26.
Okay. Under its brim were gourds for 10 cubits, compassing the sea all around. The gourds were in two rows, cast with it when it was cast. It stood on 12 oxen, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. The sea was set on them, and their rear parts were inward. Its thickness was a handbreadth. Its brim was like the brim of a cup, like the flower of a lily. It held 2,000 baths.
Okay, so try to picture this huge brazen sea that it was this thick. The bronze was this thick. You've got 12 bulls, 3 on each side, so north, south, east, and west, kind of looking like muskox protecting their little ones in the middle. And you've got all these gourds that are carved or molded into the outside. It's measuring 10 cubits from rim to rim and 5 cubits high. And it's going to hold, and I had to look up 2,000 baths, because this is not symbolic here. We're getting real amounts here. And 11,500 gallons of water that it will hold. That's a lot. And so again, in the temple, we had another sea that's there of a sort. In this case in Revelation, the sea is not blue. What color is it? It's got fire. What color is fire? What generally do we say fire is? It's red again. And it's mixed with fire. And so you have, in the sense of fire, you have the ideas of purification. You have the idea of trial. And so as we're looking at this, these people that are there, those who had been victorious over the beast in his image, well, what does it take to be victorious over the sea, over the beast in his image? We have a number of things that we're told that we've already read about this. Number one, you in chapter 13 and verse 7, he was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them, and he was given authority over every tribe, nation, people, and language, and nation. So he had all of this, this power here. But those who refused to worship him were victorious. There's that purity there. Look at verse 15 of chapter 13. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the king to be killed. So there's, if you refuse to worship it, then you're going to be killed. They're the ones who are victorious over the beast. Even though they died, they're victorious. And then also, they're going to suffer deprivation. Again, if we look at verse 17, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. So if you're not worshiping him, then you're not going to be able to do business. You're going to suffer because you can't have the things that you need. And they're going to be, in fact, as a result of that trial, and earlier in Revelation chapter 2, faithful unto death. That's how you're victorious over the beast. And that we have seen that already. And so John sees those who are victorious, they are faithful, they're standing on this sea with harps, and it's, again, a red sea because of the fire. And we can leap easily enough in the text and say, okay, so we're back at the Red Sea again, and we're right on the edge of the Red Sea. And then, if you have any doubts about that, what are they singing on the rim of the shore of the Red Sea? They're singing the Song of Moses. So all of these signs and all of this stuff is just all coming back and being brought up here. Now, I gave you, you should have a song sheet. I didn't keep one for myself, but that's lucky me. I know the song already, but... Now, this isn't the exact song as far as the music is concerned, but the neat thing about this song is that it uses these exact words. There's only one place where it's repeated, where a line is repeated, and that's "For you alone are holy," which is in the middle of verse 4. That's brought up again. All right, so what I'm going to do is play the song for you. I'm trying to remember where I found the microphone on this before.
And this will be good because when we get there, we'll know how to sing it.
Yes, right. If they're still singing this.
Probably.
Well, and let me tell you that,
be a new song.
That this song, you say, okay, this is the Song of Moses. Well, if you go over to Exodus, it's not really there. It's different from there. You go over to Deuteronomy 32, you say, wait, this isn't the song. It's like the 23rd Psalm. We got three different ones in our songbook. But John has changed the words. But if you wanted to take the time, and I noticed a place that had taken the time, I just didn't give it to you. I didn't want to take all that time. But all of these phrases you can find sprinkled all the way around through the Old Testament. So let's see. In the course of playing this, I will locate where the microphone is on this. I just did this and it started. Of course, this time it's not going to do that. Stop it.
You told it not to play, so it's
coming. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King.
There, I found it. That's just the sopranos. Here come the altos singing the same thing. Let's go ahead and start singing. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Whom I fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name. For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you. For you alone are holy. For your righteous acts have been revealed. Here's the third one. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Whom I fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name. For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you. For you alone are holy. For your righteous acts have been revealed. So I like it when people, and Sam and I were talking a little bit about this before, when they just take the words of the Bible and set them to music, and you know, I've told you, you know, in other classes and times, what the music does is it puts the words on your heart, so that you're just saying, okay, great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Do not fear thee, O Lord, and bring glory to your name, for you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you. And then it says, for you alone are holy, and for your righteous acts have been revealed. And you know, I've just sung that a few times, but they're already in there. I've already memorized most of the fourth and fifth verses, or fourth verse, third and fourth verse of Revelation 15, just because of the song. I mean, how many people learn the names of the apostles and the books of the Bible and other things by having put it to music? And so I wanted us to give that a shot and sing that. So when was the Song of Moses sung before? This is your question six. We've kind of already answered that. Exodus 15 and Deuteronomy 32. And the latter time, the Song of Witness was taught to them by Moses and by Joshua. And the basis of this song is, where John is pulling it from anyway, is the Exodus edition of that, Exodus 15, because that's after Egypt's defeat in the Red Sea. And now this song is being sung again by saints who are victorious, who have been delivered. Even though they died in the conflict physically, they overcame spiritually. And so it's a song of praise to God's glory. And as a result of that work, the song says nations will come to him. Let's go over to, keep your fingers there, go over to Romans chapter 11. And somebody read verses 11 and 12 and then verse 15. Romans 11, 11 and 12 and verse 15. Somebody that hasn't read yet. Sam, go ahead.
Again I ask, did you stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. Rather, because of their transgressions, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. But if their transgressions mean riches for the world, and their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater riches will be their full inclusion bring? And then you said 18.
And then verse 15.
For if their rejection brought reconciliation to the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead?
Okay, so the fact that the Jews rejected Jesus brought salvation to everyone. And then as we begin reading in the book of Acts, we see a lot of Jews who are accepting of the gospel and are obeying the gospel. 3,000, 5,000 men multiplying exceedingly. Even some of the priests, many of the priests are coming to the Lord. And so then the Gentiles are coming in. And what Paul says at the end is, if Jews are seeing that and now they're coming back, then it's life from the dead. They're able to come back. The gospel is still available to them, and we would hope that they would take that opportunity. And so, any other questions on that first section there, including the song? All right, let's go on down to read verses 5 through 8, which is the end of this chapter. We're not going to finish this tonight, but we'll almost finish it. After this I looked, and in heaven the temple, that is, the tabernacle of the testimony, was opened.
I almost got back to before you went on to the other thing. What was the significance of them holding harps given them by God?
It just symbols of praise.
They're going to be there praising him.
They're praising God for I mean, they've been crying out for the vengeance, and now it's coming. He's tread the wine press. The wrath is there. It's going to be poured out. And again, not a chronology, but a big picture, they can see that the judgment, they're going to be vindicated. God's going to take vengeance for them. And so, where was I? Out of the temple, the testimony was open, verse 6. Out of the temple came the seven angels with the seven plagues. And I assume that those plagues are in each of the bowls or chalices. They're not just coming out with plagues in their hands. They were dressed in clean, shining linen and wore golden sashes around their chests. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls. There we go. They're finally coming. Filled with the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. So there's a lot going on in just those little four verses there. But let's go ahead and begin. So your seventh question on your sheets is, what is the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven? Anybody have an idea?
Well, the tabernacle of testimony, we have examples of that with the testimony seems to be the ark with the things that were within it, the two tablets and that rod of Aaron and the other things that were testifying to God's power.
Okay.
And the tabernacle that was in that, which had a holy place and where God dwelt at the ark.
Okay.
That kind of a thing. And in Hebrews 8 that you were just talking about, just showing, Jesus is the minister of that tabernacle, it says.
Okay.
But I don't know what the temple is.
Okay. Well, the temple is just this later facsimile of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was built, Solomon then built the temple. But again, it was the same thing. I mean, it had the Ark of the Covenant in it, and all of those things were still in there. And so he's just using both of those expressions there in the same way. Now, when we read about Moses being given instructions, how is he supposed to build it?
According to the pattern.
According to the pattern. And in the Hebrews letter, it talks about there's the tabernacle on earth, and then there's what? The true tabernacle, the true temple in heaven. And so that's what John is seeing here now. And that's what he says there. Then I looked, and in heaven, the temple. This is the real one. These other things were the copies. These other things were the shadows of the reality of that temple, of that tabernacle that was in heaven. And it's out of this temple that these angel priests come out. They are about to pour out these bowls of judgment. They're dressed in white linen. Again, Revelation chapter 1 and verse 13, as we see the white cloth or clothing that Jesus was wearing, they are representing the high priest who's coming out of the temple of God. And we have one of the four living creatures now giving the seven angels the seven bowls. Listen, the four living creatures were very much involved in the first section with the seven seals. That's where we really read about the four creatures. We haven't seen much about them now. And now the seals, like the bowls, are representing plagues and judgments of God. The bowls continue the picture of drinking the wrath of God, or the chalices. And one person I was reading today said he really likes the word chalice, because chalice is something you drink out of. Only uncouth people drink out of bowls. And I'm one of them, because when I get down to the bottom of my cereal, I'm drinking the bowl of milk out of there. And then we are told that when all of this happened, after they've left, now the temple was filled with smoke. Where have we seen the house of God filled with smoke before?
Every time a new tabernacle or temple was dedicated, except for the last one that they built in for the Nehemiah or Ezra.
Right.
Whichever one. The last one never was.
Okay. Or we don't have a record of it happening. Yeah, so Exodus 40, somebody turn there, verses 34 and 35, and 2 Chronicles 7, and Ross is exactly right. When we have the record of it, 2 Chronicles 7, I need somebody to read verses 1 through 3. So Exodus 40, 34, and 35. Who hasn't read yet?
Okay.
Randy?
I have Second Chronicles.
Oh, you okay? So stay there for Chronicles. So Exodus 40. I'll take anybody that has it now. Okay, Tammy.
Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the Lord's glory filled the tabernacle. Moses wasn't able to enter into the tent of meeting because the cloud stayed on it, and the Lord's glory filled the tabernacle.
Okay, so even Moses couldn't go in. Not just like anyone, but even Moses couldn't. And now, Randy, 2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3.
Now when Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And the priests could not enter the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the Lord's house. When all the children of Israel saw how the fire came down and the glory of the Lord on the temple, they bowed their faces to the ground on the pavement and worshiped and praised God, saying, "Praise the Lord, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever."
Okay. So in both cases, we have the glory of the Lord there and no one can enter. And the reason no one can enter is because that's indicative of the presence of God there. You can't go in. And now we see basically what we have now is the same thing is going to be happening in the church, which is the temple we're seeing in this particular vision in God's kingdom. And if you go back to Acts chapter 2 and verse 19, where in Joel's prophecy, I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. Joel's describing the full possession of God and his people in the kingdom that's going to take place in the last days. And no one is going to be able to enter. I think we're going to be able to finish this. And so this glory that no one could enter doesn't just affect the enemies of God. The enemies of God can't go in. But the righteous can't go in either because of what's going on right here. So what does that mean? Well, I think that during this time of great trial, of great punishment, with all of this persecution, it would almost seem that evangelistic efforts also came to a halt. I mean, they're trying to stay alive physically. And that was certainly going to be true in Jerusalem, because when Jerusalem was surrounded by armies, how many faithful Christians were there left in the city? Zero if they listened to Jesus. They all left. They had that opportunity to go out. So there's not going to be anybody within the city that could do that. There wouldn't be anybody there to teach and guide anybody else in. And when it's over, people will again be able to come in, as we will see. Okay, Tim.
I was just interested in that phrase, tabernacle of the testimony. So I played with the cross references, saw a couple places in the Old Testament, Exodus and Leviticus, I believe. And in the context of both of those, it's talking about the furnishings.
Right.
But then the third place I found was Stephen's speech.
Right.
He in his describing, you know, started out as in the tabernacle of the testimony, and then temple was built, and
right,
now he's, you can't hold it.
Right. And so it wasn't just the Ark of the Covenant that had all the documents and artifacts that Mike was talking about, but what was on top of the Ark of the Covenant?
The angels that were facing.
And what was that place called? The
mercy seat.
The mercy seat. And who was, in essence, who was on the mercy seat? That's where God sat. That was his throne. That was him being among them. And so, again, this is kind of a preamble bringing us up from the harvest of the earth, and now the grapes of wrath have been trampled outside the city. The bowls of this wrath are now in the hands of these angels, and one by one right after the other, through the seven angels, it will be poured out on the earth and on the land. And what we're going to see as we start chapter 16 next week is the pouring out of these plagues or wrath have corresponding relationships to the plagues that God poured out on Egypt. And of course, they would see that. They would recognize that. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
Also, if you can't enter the temple or the tabernacle, you can't communicate with God. So there is no more delays. You can't ask for forgiveness for the people. It's like, I'm not hearing any of that anymore.
Right. Yeah, his ears are closed now because now comes the wrath. And again, this is symbolic. It's being signified by these things. I'd hate to say nobody was saved at all during this time, but symbolically, that's the picture that we have here.